Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm well.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up, in controversies and non-controversies, how much input should an engineer have on an auteur's film? That's just one of the questions at the heart of a reported feature on Netflix's Growing Pains. As the company's tech background, in which criticism is welcomed from all corners in the hopes of improving products, butts up against aspirations to become a proper movie studio, which are a little bit more hierarchical. As Zoe Schiffer reports in The Verge, some employees believed they should weigh in on all the actual content of Netflix's capital C content. Obviously, this has to do greatly with the debates over Dave Chappelle, and those need no recounting here. But it goes beyond that, with employees weighing in on films the company had paid for to produce or purchased on the market. Here's Schiffer, quote, "To those outside the company, it might have seemed odd or frustrating that engineers were trying to help shape movie plot lines. At Netflix, staffers saw it as their right and responsibility to bring company values to life through the content that appeared on the platform," end quote. Of course, creatives have been forced to take notes from people who have only a limited understanding of what is going on in the world of movies for forever, more or less, right? But at least they have to listen to studio heads, because studio heads have green light power and the ability to stroke eight-figure checks. The random engineer who belongs to some issue advocacy group within the company does not. They're just kind of a pain in the ass. At issue here is a broader question about the role of the employee and the employer, right? Is the employee there to make the company a success and support what the employer does? Or is the employee there to educate the employer, to instruct the employer about the moral quandary surrounding the employer's products, to impose the employee's belief system on the employer's company as a whole? You could probably guess my take on this. Engineers who don't like the movies or stand-ups specials that Netflix puts together should screw off and find a new place of employment. But then again, I love telling people to screw off all the time. I am a person who's very much on the side of management over labor, despite being labor myself. Alyssa, am I making a mistake by not considering the feelings of the people who write the code for a living and envision themselves as mini Irving Thalbergs?
No, but I do think that there is an extent to which Netflix and actually a lot of other companies have set themselves up for this kind of situation. At Netflix, as with I think many other companies, there is a tendency to treat diversity and inclusivity groups as sort of focus groups, as, you know, sort of unpaid in-house PR that can, you know, alert you to potential problems with a product or an initiative. And so these groups are called on to say, hey, you know, what's going to get us in trouble with this? And when you start consulting them, it's hard to pull back. You fostered the expectation that they do have some sort of power or authority over the content. And Netflix, it sounds like from this feature, did that a lot and now kind of wants to pull back and change expectations. And I think that, you know, it does not make an enormous amount of sense to consult people who are not in the business of making content about whether the content is good or bad. If a high value for you is not getting in trouble with advocates, then it may make sense to consult people, probably not just your own employees, but sort of outside diversity groups, whatever, about potential pitfalls. But if what you do as a company is make broad-based entertainment, do a lot of niche stuff that will appeal to niche audiences, and you want to have a huge, wide-spectrum library, then that's a very different thing from putting out content that is inoffensive, right? And so I think there is a lot of sort of entitled-sounding behavior in this piece, but I think that Netflix is going through sort of a larger shift in its articulation of its mission, in a way that was probably inevitably going to cause it some management headaches. And so I am not terribly sympathetic to someone who is hired to write code and then thinks that they should have some sort of veto power over what content that code is used to deliver to consumers. But I'm also not terribly sympathetic to executives who try to buy themselves out of potential PR crises on the cheap by pulling in employees to do work that they're not actually really suited to do, and then change their mind about what they want employees to be doing without actually managing that shift down the organizational substack.
One of the things that jumps out in this piece is the extent to which some of these groups in-house are being treated as almost diversity readers.
Absolutely.
Like a YA publishing firms.
But they're diversity readers that you don't have to, you know, spend money on an outside contract for, right? Like, they're free. And I think there are a lot of examples of companies using employees to do things that aren't really on their job, whether because they're, you know, they're on tight deadlines, it's on the fly, or because, like, it is cheap and easy and you can sort of keep it all in-house. But I think that is a poor managerial decision when it leads to a blurring of roles, and especially of hierarchies that are ultimately quite important in making and marketing big projects like the ones that Netflix is in the business of making and delivering.
Peter, what do you make of this story? I am fascinated by it, just as somebody who, like, has never had to really deal with this sort of thing and has never really put up with the younglings coming in and saying, we should do it a different way. What do you make of this?
So the strangest part of this story is that this is being treated as a labor issue. Like, if you're a union person, then, like, quality of life issues, like, how many hours do you have to work? How much vacation do you get? How much do you get paid? What's the health insurance like? Those are labor issues. The idea that an engineer isn't getting input into Netflix's acquisition decisions or, like, the plot line of Stranger Things or something is bizarre. That is being treated as something that is, like, a legitimate issue for unions and for labor to be negotiating. And if anything, it's actually the reverse, right? Because what you were describing, Sonny, what you were talking about, Alyssa, is that these folks are being asked to do essentially unpaid labor outside of the jobs they were hired to do. If you're hired to, like, write good algorithms that recommend to Sonny only movies that have Gerard Butler kind of, like, running around, you know, shooting guns and acting like a badass, and, like, instead you're like, man, I wish Gerard Butler would star in movies with better representation, and, like, the endings weren't so down, or, like, they showed, like, the sadness of, like, no, your job is to, like, recommend, is to produce code that says, Sonny, here's another movie with Gerard Butler, right? Like, that's it. That's your job. Don't do the other part where you're like, man, is this offensive to the whatever sort of minority or interest group you may or may not represent? And so it's like, to me, they should actually be, the labor issue is that they're being asked to do work beyond the scope of their job. Alyssa is totally right that they've set themselves up for failure by treating employees as sort of in-house focus groups. But I also think they've set themselves up for failure in another way, which is having this sort of open internal culture where anybody can ask, anything at any time. And the idea is, look, they're trying to say, look, we value everybody's opinion, and we're trying, that everyone here might have something to add, and we want to be transparent with our employees. I totally get that, and that's not even necessarily a bad value to have. But what you've said is, to a company of thousands and thousands of people, suddenly everyone is kind of a producer on all of the product, on all of the scripts here. And that's just crazy. It is fundamentally antithetical to the way that filmmaking should work. And so I would actually just point to people. I've had opportunity for, I don't even remember why, but I was recently looking at the Directors Guild of America's contracts. And one of the things that the Directors Guild of America is famous for is protecting directors in terms of their credits. So it's basically impossible to get a co-directing credit on a film unless you are part of a legitimate team, like the Duffer Brothers or something like that. And the idea here is that producers, who are the money men, studios behind films, should not be able to fire directors in the middle of movies, bring on another one, or, like, let you direct the movie and then be like, we don't like this, we're just gonna hire somebody else to direct a bunch of scenes, slot them into your movie, right? The labor issue there is that they have demanded as part of their contract that studios respect the singularity of their vision. Now, obviously, there are compromises that get made, right? Sometimes Joss Whedon gets brought in to redirect most of Justice League, and it's kind of no one's movie. Sometimes there's the Rami Malek, Queen film, right? That because this is directed by no one, right? That nobody ends up directing. There are obviously some of these compromises, but even those are, like, those are big deal, like, rare instances that get complicated with the guild. And, like, what is happening here is random engineers who may or may not be smart people, who may or may not have good film opinions, are, like, it doesn't matter even if your ideas are good. It's actually irrelevant. The person in charge of making the show or the movie is the director, the showrunner, the writer, the creators who are actually involved. And the creative process needs to be designed for labor reasons as well as for creative, like, artistic reasons, to keep out interference. It's actually, I think, pretty telling that, as far as I understand, this is like a, I saw this on a Twitter thread, not like reported in Variety, but my understanding is that Taylor Sheridan, when he pitched Yellowstone to, I believe it's Paramount Plus that that service is on, he walked in and he said, look, I'll do this show, but here's my, here's one of the things I'm going to demand. No notes, ever. Final cut on everything. And this is something that directors eventually like to demand is final cut, sometimes no notes or minimal notes, or I don't have to respond to them, because in fact, the singularity and purity of a director's vision or of a showrunner or writing team or whoever it is really important to the creative process. And that's, and Netflix is just messing it up by sort of saying, well, you know, we're all partners in this. No, you're not all partners. Someone is making this movie and it's not you.
And Peter, beyond that, I mean, one of the things that was interesting in the story that Sunny was talking about is there was apparently this sort of emblematic, like, open Google document at Netflix where anyone could put in a question and it was expected that the executive team would answer it. And beyond the sort of purity of vision question for directors, that is an insane way for an executive of a large publicly traded company to be spending their time. And I say this as the person who, you know, is most of a labor hippie on this podcast, but like, that is a stupid way for Reed Hastings and Ted Sarandos to be spending their time, is like having to check in on a Google document to be like, what does like so-and-so who works in craft services think about my comedy special Light Up? Like, they should never spend time doing that. They should quarterly have town halls where people can submit questions, and they should actually make sure that like a wide variety of questions from throughout the company get answered there, because it's good to help people feel heard. It's good for morale. And also, like, people sometimes will ask, unexpected people will sometimes ask good questions. But the idea that the executive of a company that's spending $17 billion a year on content should be monitoring a Google document is an insane waste of managerial energy.
That's crazy. I mean, I want to flip this on its head a little bit here and say one thing that I think the employees do basically have right is that in the piece, they there's a portion where they talk about how in the course of changing the cultural memo, right, the culture memo, there was some discussion about whether or not employees should feel obligated to promote a piece as opposed to just work on it. And I think that that's actually a fair compromise to say, like, all right, if you work at the company and we put out something you don't like, you shouldn't feel any need to, like, go on Twitter and talk about it, right? Like, that's a totally reasonable thing to say.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, unless your job is marketing or unless you are, a star or a principal in the thing and you have a contractual obligation to market it and to only say good things about it, not only to only say good things about it, but to affirmatively say good things about it. And that, like, but in that case, it's a job function. You're, the algorithm guy who's delivering the Gerard Butler movies to Sonny does not have any obligation to say that he likes Cuties or whatever.
Cuties is actually a good movie, not pornographic. Bear say.
I don't want. Let's not get into that. Let's not get back into that. We've already done that
double
episode.
Double segments.
All right. So, what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that Netflix has told programmers to stop bothering creatives with all their whining? Alyssa,
the edict is a controversy. The like Netflix's ability to manage its own internal culture is a controversy.
Peter,
the fact that this had to happen is a controversy. Netflix's response is not.
I say this is a controversy kind of all around. The employees just need to, you know, just write your code. You're not Steven Spielberg. Okay, we don't need your input here. Make sure to stop by atma.thebulwark.com on Friday for a special members-only bonus episode on the curious case of the aging movie star. They keep getting older while the audience remains the same age. Feels like a problem, no? And now, on to the main event. Thor, Love and Thunder. The movie picks up more or less where Avengers Endgame left off. Thor is now basically one of the Guardians of the Galaxy. He's traveling the cosmos with Star-Lord and his team, doing good works, but kind of depressed, because, you know, he doesn't have a special someone. Meanwhile, Natalie Portman's Jane Foster, who was previously Thor's special someone, she's dying of cancer. Until that is, she takes possession of a reconstituted Mjolnir, the mythical hammer, which turns her into Lady Thor. Thor and Lady Thor need to team up against Gore the God Butcher, who's played by Christian Bale. He wants to kill all the gods because the gods of the MCU are kind of dicks. They're just kind of dicks. All the time to everyone. Even perhaps especially the other gods, as we learn when Thor and Lady Thor and Valkyrie, who's played by Tessa Thompson, ask Zeus, who's played by a very heavy Russell Crowe, for help to stop Gore. I've talked about this before, but maybe never on the show, so here we go. I don't really like Goofy Thor, as envisioned by writer-director Taika Waititi. I'm very clearly in the minority on this, given that I was one of the few people to give Thor Ragnarok a negative review. I prefer the vaguely Shakespearean Thor, particularly Kenneth Branagh's Thor. That's the Thor that we had for the first two movies and the first two Avenger movies. He's a bit grandiose, but he's still prone to comic interludes, as in the first film when he's smashing the coffee mugs in a diner, and he's demanding more to be brought to him. Ah, it's very funny. I like that. Those movies are frequently very funny, and Thor is frequently very funny in them. And the idea that, like, Taika Waititi showed up and he finally imbues this character with some comedy, is that's just wrong. That's all wrong. Waititi's vision for Thor is not really funny, but goofy. He's silly. He's a goon. And there are moments in Love and Thunder where this works, right? Like when the enchanted axe that he uses now, Stormbreaker, starts getting jealous that Mjolnir is back in the picture. Pretty funny. I like that. It's clever. But overall, the effect is too silly to have any real impact. I find it all very grating. Again, I am in the minority on this. But I am surprised that Love and Thunder has received much harsher treatment from critics than its predecessor, because it's more similar than dissimilar. And if you like the tone of the first one, there's no reason you shouldn't like the tone of this. Obviously, something has changed, given this film's modest Rotten Tomatoes score. It's at only 51% fresh with top critics, and bad for the MCU B+ from CinemaScore. For what it's worth, didn't hate Love and Thunder, exactly. I was just kind of bored with it. Just kind of bored. I don't know. That's how I feel more or less with all the MCU movies these days. And that feeling seems to be spreading. Peter, has the series run its course, or am I just wishcasting, given that this picture opened to another $140 million boffo box office on its opening weekend?
Well, I think the audience is still pretty clearly there for the Marvel Universe. And we've seen that regardless of whether the movies are particularly good or not. I mean, it just since the pandemic and with the MCU films started coming back out, they've all done at least pretty well and have tended to outperform movies, even sort of other blockbuster movies, even relative to sort of pandemic environmental circumstances. So I don't think the series has run its course. I also think that there's a bunch of unexploited Marvel properties, namely the big ones that they picked up from Fox, the Fantastic Four and the X-Men. There's clearly 10 more years of movies, provided that they do something competent enough here and that the audiences, you know, keep showing up. I don't think that it has run out of steam. I do think that the goofy Thor vision is not working. And I found this movie to be among the worst of the Marvel films. It's not just sort of okay in the way that a lot of Marvel films are okay. This movie really just did not work for me. And I think it's mostly Waititi's fault, because I don't find his shtick particularly funny. I think it's I especially don't like it at length. Right, I think it works best on television, small screen, in a short format. Extended to feature length, it just sort of wears out its welcome pretty quick. First of all, I don't enjoy the jokes. But what the jokes all do is they undercut the seriousness or significance of every single moment, and at every point where like a plot might go somewhere, they sort of ramble off onto some sort of side thing without allowing it to develop. But then when the story wants to go someplace that might mean something, it might have an impact, right? Here's a woman dying of cancer. Here is a villain who has lost his child and is like heartbroken over this and is, you know, fighting all the gods in the universe as a result. The movie is like, has spent so much time signaling, nothing matters. You shouldn't care about this, that it just doesn't land at all. And so you have a movie that just aggressively tells you in every scene, none of this matters. It's all sort of dumb. It's all silly. It's all weightless. And then at the end kind of tries to wrap up with, you know, but it does matter because of the, we all care about our children or whatever. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work like in the small bits, like because they're not funny enough. And because they're telling you not to care about the movie. And then it doesn't work in the big bits because the movie has told you repeatedly over and over by the time you get to that last, you know, 15 or 20 minutes of this film, that you shouldn't care. And so I walked out of this movie just feeling like, I don't care at all. I thought this was kind of a slog. It felt long, even though it was came in under 2 hours. My wife saw it with me and was like, oh, that was, you know, that was a kind of enjoyable 2.5 hours to spend at the theater. It was like an hour and 56 minute movie that felt like it was 2.5 hours long. And I think even if you enjoyed it, like it moves more slowly than it needs to, in part because, again, it has this sort of digressive, like, resistance to actually engaging with anything, even the idea of somebody who has cancer, even the idea of a God-murdering crazy person who has lost all of these, who has lost his child and lost his faith. It won't engage with it in any, it's not like these movies need to be ultra serious or dark. At the same time, there's like, I think there is a, like, a kind of quite dark and quite grim version of this movie that could work very well. And this movie is just the exact opposite of that. I didn't like it at all. I think it's probably a little better than Eternals, but mainly because it's under 2 hours. But this is even by Marvel's sort of like mediocre standards, this is in the bottom five or six Marvel films.
Alyssa, did the child subplot work for you? Because I've talked before about how children have like kind of changed how I'm able to watch movies, and like there was a part of me that like as Thor is being given this child to take care of, who was not in the movie at all, really, and just kind of shows up at the end. He's like, okay, my kid now. I kind of hated that. I felt like weirdly emotionally manipulative, and also it didn't work. Like it didn't actually manipulate me the right way.
So just to be spoilerific for a second, you're warned. Beat, go away if you haven't actually watched this movie. Although while you're listening to this podcast, if you haven't watched this movie, whatever. So the climax of this movie is really weird, right? Because, and it's interesting because it's kind of visually attractive, and Christian Bale is great at it, as he is in like every minute that he's on screen in this movie. So his character, Gore the God Butcher, is dying and has this chance to make one wish that will be granted. And what he wants to wish for his dead daughter to be returned to him, but because he knows he's dying, he sort of worries that it's a selfish act. And Thor and Jane Foster are like, no, she won't be alone. Because, like, Gore knows he's going to, like, see his daughter die. And then, like, she'll be an orphan. Woohoo. If both this character and this plot arc had, like, been set up to reach this point over the three previous Thor movies, I think it could have been amazing. But this movie kind of retcons in Thor's desire for a child. Like, there's this sort of jokey montage about like his and Jane Foster's relationship where like he sees a baby in a stroller and it's like, ah, that would be nice. But like, we have no particular sign other than that over the previous movies that like Thor has a deep and abiding desire to be a dad, even though that would be a kind of interesting counterpoint to what the previous movies do with his relationship with his father, his, you know, complicated relationship with Loki. You know, there is a lot of like sibling and parent stuff in these movies, but it's all about Thor like working out his own stuff with his dad, as opposed to him being like, I have worked out this stuff, it would be interesting to go ahead and have a kid and to do it with this particular person, right? Because his desire to be a dad is presented in the context of his relationship with Jane, that like he would like to be a parent with her and she is also dying. And so like there's actually, the movie just totally skates over Gore's correct insight that there's something kind of sick and selfish about wishing his daughter back into the world so he can say goodbye to her and like have this last moment of happiness, only to turn her over to a total stranger. And, you know, the last sequence in the movie has this kind of jokey, you know, riff of Thor trying to get his daughter ready for, you know, ready to go out and like save another planet. He's making her breakfast. She's being a jerk about what shoes she wants to wear. And like, as the parent of a 4-year-old who, like, I spent 25 minutes trying to figure out how to get my 4-year-old to wear appropriate shoes to camp this morning, in part because all of her shoes have vanished somewhere in the house. Like, that's very accurate in terms of what it's like to take care of a small human. But, again, there's no weight to it. And that tendency to sort of undercut everything is real weird, you know? I mean, this is also a movie that, like, pivots on Gore has kidnapped a bunch of kids, but, like, we never see any of their parents as sort of distinct individuals other than a mass of like, oh, my child. They're referred to collectively as like the children.
The children. And but can I just interject here? Because there's the one thing I think this movie does really well is there's this one scene where Gore is interacting with the kids.
Yes.
And he's trying to, like, comfort them because he doesn't actually want to hurt them. Like, he is not a villain in the mustache twirling, I want to tie a damsel to the tracks sort of sense. He just wants to kill all these asshole gods. And so, like, he's actually trying to play with the kids and make them happy. And he, like, conjures up a creature and kills it in front of them. And he's, like, trying to figure out why they're so horrified. And Christian Bale plays this perfectly with kind of this wide-eyed, almost innocence to him. He's like absurd and like it, but it does nothing with that. It does absolutely, the movie does absolutely nothing with this, or
it wastes a really good Christian Bale performance.
Yeah,
that is, that like is like strangely effective. Like you can see that there's like a great movie that could have been built out of whatever the hell movie Christian Bale thought he was in.
Yeah,
this movie definitely is not it.
No, and that's true even from the beginning, where you have this enormously affecting opening to the movie where Bale's character is, like, traveling across the desert with his dying daughter. He's, like, praying for her salvation and basically being like, this is not for me, like, just, like, water or food for my daughter. And she dies. He thinks he has found the gods, and they're just indifferent. But part of what's interesting about that sequence is that, like, even in that sequence, Waititi can't resist making Gore's gods, like, kind of goofy and insubstantial, right? Like, they're, like, whatever the divine equivalent of bimbos are, right? And in a weird way, that undercuts, like, the cruelty of the moment, right? Like, this thing that should be, like, an immensely harrowing confrontation is undercut by his, Waititi's just magnetic attraction to, like, fluff and goofery. And, you know, again, it's a waste because, again, you could do something really interesting where you have some intervening scenes where you see how Gore has this parental impulse that has just been, like, distorted or lost touch with over time. Again, there's, like, there's a good movie about parenting here. And actually, this conversation, just the treatment of sort of parenting in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is very odd. Like, you know, kids are just props in some weird ways.
I mean, the only real parental relationship that the whole thing has had, and one of the reasons why these movies are the ones that are the best, is Tony Stark and Peter Parker.
Well, and then Spider-Man and Peter Parker and Aunt May.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, Tony Stark and Aunt May basically being the father and mother of
yeah. Well, Peter and Parker. And then also having, like, Vulture be the dad, and that being sort of part of his persona. But yeah, it's you know, it's very much a franchise that's, like, into the whole chosen family thing, but wants to pull in the gravity of actual biological family, but is never able to really commit to or explore it.
This movie made me have a thought that I have never had before that Sonny will appreciate, which is, I wished Zack Snyder had directed this.
Yes.
Because Zack
yes.
Snyder, as many problems as I have with him, he does two things really well. He shows the gap between mortals and gods and how terrifying it can be, better than almost any other director. And that's something that this movie was missing, right? And you can imagine Christian Bale's, you know, Gore the God Butcher's anger at these cruel, indifferent gods who are simply, you know, who simply don't care about the mortals like him, about their followers. You can imagine Zack Snyder just nailing that. The other thing he does well is some of this female empowerment stuff that the movie vaguely gestures at with Natalie Portman and just doesn't develop in any way or give any weight to, because Waititi's uninterested in actually taking things anywhere other than, like, oh, what if we just made everything like a small joke? And that's it, right? And that's all we get from she becomes Thor and dies of cancer is, oh, here's a small joke.
Female empowerment will kill you, ladies. Like,
and Zack Snyder takes that stuff really seriously and is very good at showing, you know, at sort of developing those arcs and developing those characters. And he could have taken, not this script exactly, but there's barely a story here, but there is one. I think, like, if you look for it, and there was like there are some actually good story ideas just buried beneath mountains of triviality.
I mean, the other thing Zack Snyder does is he knows how to shoot action. And this movie is like remarkably ugly. Like the whole last sequence where the kids and Thor and Natalie Portman are fighting against Christian Bale and his dark monsters, I could barely make out what's happening in any of that. And like there are a couple of sequences that look pretty good, like the Shadow Planet where they're like running around the planet, like interesting visual.
Yeah,
not bad.
The hand to hand combat there is not bad.
But the actual like big climactic action sequence is almost incomprehensibly dark. I mean, I don't know if it was a projection issue at my theater. I doubt it because I saw it at my local draft house. It was not very well lit. I don't understand how you can put a sequence like that out in a $250 million movie or whatever this costs.
Well, it's so the dark sequences are too dark, but for the most part, the movie is just aggressively bright. There's a great cutting line at the end of Scott Tobias's review in the reveal where he compares this movie to an HDTV screensaver in a Best Buy. And it's like, that's exactly what this looks like. Just aggressively over bright and sort of, you know, ugly and computer generated, but just there to be like, hey, we've got a purple and gold. It's not pleasant to look at.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Thor, Love and Thunder? Alyssa?
Thumbs down.
Peter?
Sadly, a thumbs down.
I also give it a thumbs down. I just did not care for it. All right, that is it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for our bonus episode on Friday. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.